Plain Talk Series Number 4, Sculptors of Life by William W. Walter. We are all sculptors working out our own ideals and leaving the impress of mind on the body as well as on the history and marble, chiseling to higher excellence or leaving to rot and ruin the mind's ideals. So wrote Mary Baker Eddy in The People's Idea of God, page 7. A sculptor may be said to be one who carves, chisels, or gives external or visible form to the thought, images, or ideals which he has in mind. The part of the statement to which I wish especially to call the reader's attention is that we are leaving the impress of mind on the body. For this part of the statement is of vital importance to our health and happiness. Webster defines the word impress to mean to stamp or to imprint, etc. The first question that arises in the mind of the beginner in metaphysics when reading Mrs. Eddy's statement is this: is it true that the mind of an individual can or does imprint its thought ideals on his body? To the understanding metaphysician, this is no longer an open question. He has proof in plenty in his everyday practice in healing the sick that the mentality of the individual does constantly impress its thought ideals on the body. In my search to prove the truth of this statement, I was led to investigate birthmarks, etc., phenomena with which nearly everyone is more or less familiar. I found much that was enlightening and interesting, and will mention a few cases. A woman stepped from her porch to the walk. As she did so, a large frog jumped to the walk at her feet, startled the woman, hastily grasped her skirt just below the hip. Her child, when born, had a clear impression or outline of the frog on its body at the point corresponding to the one at which the mother had grasped her skirt. Another woman, in preparing breakfast, was slicing a piece of liver. Just as a knife cut through, one half of the liver slipped from the table. The woman, making a frantic effort to keep it from falling on the floor, caught it and pressed it against her limb at a point halfway between the knee and the thigh. The child, when born, at the age of 15, when I saw the mark, had a discoloration on his limb that looked exactly like the half of a liver, both in color and shape, even to the veins of the liver where it had been cut being plainly visible. Another woman, reading a story in which a baby was born with a club foot, sympathized so greatly with the mother that when her own child was born, it had a club foot, which fully corresponded to the description given in the story she had read. There are many more instances that I could cite to establish the fact that the mentality does give impress to certain of its thoughts in the case of this kind. My search having fully proved to me that the mother's thought, under certain conditions, does imprint itself on the body of her offspring. My next research was to determine whether or not the individual's own thought, after he reached the point of self-reason, is ever imprinted on his body. This was not so easily proved, because the thought imprint of the individual mentality on its body is constant and effected almost unconsciously. Few there are who have not experienced the effect or impress of fear thought in one manner or another. All have experienced the impress of fear thought in the momentary stoppage or acceleration of the heartbeat. Many know, or at least have heard, instances of the hair turning permanently white under the impress of great mental stress. During the past winter's flu epidemic, a young woman who had been dreading and fearing an attack became ill and was told by her physician that she was suffering from a well-defined influenza case. This so frightened her that her hair became white in a few hours. A case of eczema came to me for treatment. There was a spot on the arm, oval in shape, about 4 inches in length and 3 inches in width, but no other evidence of the disease on the patient's body. When the patient insisted that I look at the spot, I complied and was immediately impressed with the similarity to a picture which advertised an eczema cure. The advertisement, as I'd often seen it, was done in color. It was a large, very striking to the eye, and being placed at one end of the long bridge, was the outstanding feature of the view of all who crossed the bridge. Conference with the patient developed the fact that she walked across this bridge every day in going to her place of employment, and that she had an abhorrence of the picture. Here was a clear case of the effect upon the body of fear and abhorrence through thought activity. The image, so detested and so frequently before the mentality of the patient, became outlined upon the patient's body in exactly the same situation in which it confronted her eyes. Mrs. Eddy, in writing on this subject, page 10, The People's Idea of God, wrote, "We possess our own body, and make it harmonious or discordant according to the images that thought reflects upon it." Here is the unqualified statement, that a discordant or erring thought is impressed on the body as discord, and further, that a harmonious or right thought is impressed or shown forth as harmony or health. It is thus asserted that our wrong thinking is responsible for our ills, and our right thinking for our health and healing. True indeed it is that we are sculptors of our bodies and bodily conditions, and if we only knew it, of our surrounding conditions as well. The following verses can be found on page 7 of The People's Idea of God by Mary Baker Eddy. Chisel in hand stood a sculptor boy, with his marble block before him. and his face lit up with a smile of joy, as an angel dream passed over him. He carved the dream on that shapeless stone with many a sharp incision. With heaven's own light the sculptor shone. He had caught the angel vision. Sculptors of life are we as we stand, with our lives uncarved before us, waiting the hour when at God's command our life dream passes o'er us. If we carve it then on the yielding stone with many a sharp incision, its heavenly beauty shall be our own, our life, that angel vision. The chisel in hand is your thought. The sculptor boy is yourself, your mentality. The marble block is your body, or metaphysically your thought, conclusion, or understanding, the visible embodiment of your thinking. The smile of joy is occasioned through the new and true idea coming to consciousness, namely, that all things are possible through the application of right thought. The angel dream is the mind model or realization that health, happiness, success, that is perfection, can be won by the right understanding of the individual mental power. The dream mind model that he carved on that shapeless stone was perfection, and the sharp incision was his own positive right thought. With heaven's own light, understanding, the sculptor shone, worked mentally. He had caught the angel vision. He had gained the understanding of understanding. Sculptors of life, God, perfect mind, are we as we stand, as we actually are, with our lives, God's stated or perfected consciousness, uncarved before us, as yet not understood by us, waiting the hour when at God's command, that is, waiting the hour when understanding has unfolded our individual mentalities sufficiently so that our life dream passes over us, so that the realization of the possibility of our self-perfection comes to our thought. If we carve it then, if we then apply this understanding of the all-power of right thought on the yielding stone, upon the erring material sense of life, namely that matter and evil exist, with many a sharp incision, with many a positive or decisive right thought, its heavenly beauty, health, and happiness shall be our own, shall be our own experience, our life's the angel vision. These verses, when rightly understood, hold great metaphysical light and give us an insight into the inherent possibility and power possessed by the individual mentality, and suggest how actual perfection or perfect consciousness, the God state, may be obtained. After we partially understand, or are willing to admit, that the mind does leave its imprint on the body and our life experience, the next question naturally is, how is the effect produced and how can we control the process? On the same page of the people's idea of God, on which these verses appear, Mrs. Eddy also shows how the mind leaves its impress on the body. She wrote, "To remove these objects of sense called sickness and disease, we must appeal to mind to improve its subject and objects of thought and give to the body those better delineations." There is the how. We must cease thinking imperfection and think only perfection, and always outline the body in perfection and not in imperfection as we now do, for the body is the embodiment or visible expression of the individual mentality and automatically expresses the conviction and conclusion of the mentality. Each individual has a mind model of himself and his environment. The individual mind model is made by the individual and is the result following his habitual thinking along specific lines. The mentality, through thinking, embodies its thought in the visible universe. If the mind model that you have created of yourself is an imperfect or sickly one, the mentality cannot do otherwise than to give visible action, feeling, and form to this imperfect mind model. For the mind model is the subject or model in the invisible or thought universe, which the mentality reproduces in the visible universe. On page 248, line 13, Science and Health, Mrs. Eddy wrote, "We are all sculptors, working in various forms, molding and chiseling thought. What is the model before mortal mind? Is it perfection, joy, sorrow, sin, suffering? Are you reproducing it? There is no doubt that each individual has a more or less imperfect mind model of himself and is reproducing this imperfect model in the ills and imperfections that we see all about us. All have mind models that are imperfect both as to mind and body. All have the imperfect or false sense that we are the helpless victims of fate or environment, that we lack understanding, lack power, lack everything. If the nature of mind is such that it reproduces its mind model, can it be wondered at that the visible expression of such imperfect mind models are helplessness, ignorance, poverty, sin, sickness, death, and all manner of evil conditions?" On the same page of Science and Health, Mrs. Eddy shows the remedy. She wrote, "To remedy this, we must form perfect models in thought and look at them continually. We must form perfect models of what? why of ourselves and of our bodies and of our environment, no other sense can be taken from Mrs. Eddy's words. To think of ourselves as frail human beings with no sure defense against accident and disease, to think of ourselves as dependent upon some other power than our own for salvation, success, and happiness, to think that we have a body that is subject to discord, deformity, and decay, to think of ourselves as servants instead of masters, to think of ourselves as incapable rather than capable, imperfect instead of perfect, these are the erring thoughts, the form that imperfect human mind model, and which we see expressed about us with all manner of imperfection. These erring human beliefs of imperfection with the erring mind models which they have created must be abandoned, and in their stead we must mentally entertain the mind model of everything in condition as perfect. We must steadily maintain this perfect mind model before our mental gaze by constantly thinking of ourselves, our bodies, and our environment as being absolutely perfect. If we can enhance our sense of perfection by having a clearly defined outline in our mind, then it is wise to maintain such a model. On page 260, Mrs. Eddy wrote, "Mortals must change their ideals in order to improve their models. A sick body is evolved from sick thoughts. You think of yourself or your body as imperfect or sick, and from this wrong thinking your mentality has evolved a sick body. The one vital point that was not made plain and that should have been is this. If a sick body is evolved from the sickly thinking of the individual, then it should also have been plainly stated that the individual's healthy thinking would heal him. This great fact, so necessary to correct understanding, should not have been obscured by capitalizing the word mind, as though it were something other than the individual's own right thought. Among the thousands of Christian scientists with whom I have talked on this subject, I have found but one who knew that his own right mind or thought is a divine mind spoken of by Mrs. Eddy, and is the real healer of sickness and ill. All the rest of these students thought of the divine mind as something other than their own right thought." On page 217, volume 1, third edition of Science and Health, these words appear. "Explain to your patient, audibly as he can bear it, the utter control that mind holds over the body. Show him how it induces disease by certain thoughts, and how it can remedy it by opposite ones. Very plain indeed, and no mystery connected with the method at all. Now, note that this enlightening statement appears in the Christian Science textbook of today, page 417, line 27. Explain audibly to your patient, as soon as they can bear it, the complete control which mind holds over the body. Show them how mortal mind seems to induce disease by certain fears and false conclusions, and how divine mind can cure by opposite thought." The statement in question also appears in the 14th edition of Science and Health, in the same wording as in the 3rd edition. In the 37th edition, it appears much the same as in the present, that is, the word mind is capitalized, although unlike the present edition, it merely reads, "mind can cure," instead of "divine mind" as at present. No doubt the grammatical construction of the latter statement is very much better than the former, but Christian Science is not primarily a grammatical work. It is a work to give mental enlightenment to the individual, and the former statement does this, while the latter blinds the individual mentality and prolongs the old orthodox view of two powers, namely, God and devil, divine mind and mortal mind. According to the later statement, each of these powers seems to be independent, outside, and not under the direct control of the individual himself. This view is a serious misconception. With this erroneous view in mind, the individual is the unwitting tool or slave of his own right and wrong thought, but attributes the evil that results from his own wrong thinking to a thing called mortal mind, and the good he receives from his own right thought to be an undefined something called divine mind. This leaves him just as helpless and unable to be the arbiter of his own fate, arbiter of his life experience, as he was when under the old belief in a personal God and a personal devil. Surely some will soon awaken to the true state of affairs and seek the simple, unveiled truth with its fundamental proof so plainly given in my book entitled The Sickle. We are all sculptors, Science and Health, page 248, and the chisel with which we carve is our thought. When we think wrong or evil thoughts, we impress the thought either upon our bodies or environment, and we experience the evil or sickness that we think. This is the work of our mentalities when in error, and the new name given by Mrs. Eddy to our wrong thinking is mortal mind. Again, when we think truly, or truth, the facts of being, we think of ourselves and everything else as perfect and good, and we impress this right thought or truth upon our bodies and environments, and then we experience the real or true condition of life, namely goodness and perfection. This good and perfect result is the work of our mentalities when thinking truly or in conformity with actuality or reality, and the new name given by Mrs. Eddy to this right thinking or right mental activity is divine mind. Do I hear some science students say, I do not believe this? Well, it does not matter, for none can change the facts of existence by their disbelief, and the disbelief will retard none but the blind believers. Would it not be more scientific to withhold judgment in so vital a question until individually proved or disproved by actual trial or application? If the individual will correctly and persistently apply right thought to some minor problem with no sense of outside aid, he will receive proof by the healing accomplished that no other power than the individual's own right thought is needed to effect healing. A short time ago, a Christian Science practitioner came to me asking advice upon a certain case. In the course of the conversation, I had occasion to remark that she should mentally entertain a mind model or mental outline of perfection, and also instruct her patient to exchange his mind model of imperfection for one of perfection. The practitioner remarked, "But Mr. Walter, my teacher taught that it was not correct to outline in Christian Science healing." That teacher is wrong if Mrs. Eddy is correct, for she wrote in Science and Health, page 485, "If thought yields its dominion to other powers, it cannot outline on the body its own beautiful images, but it effaces them and delineates foreign agents called disease and death." Again, on page 208, line 29, she expressly bids you to outline. She writes, "You embrace your body in your thought, and you should delineate upon its thoughts of health, not of sickness." The word delineate, according to Webster, means to outline. The mind models of the mentality do become visible or are embodied, and these mind models are its thought outlines. Mrs. Eddy, in speaking of the painter, says in substance that he could not paint a landscape with the mental image of a boa constrictor before his mind, which is the same as saying that we cannot produce a perfect work with an imperfect model or outline in mind. To carry this to a logical conclusion, it can be seen that the practitioner who endeavors to banish all sense of outline from mind, or who has no outline in mind, can produce no visible or external condition or embodiment. When there is nothing but a blank before the mentality, it can produce nothing but a blank. The fact of the matter is that no practitioner or anyone else can think a single thought without the appearance in the mind of at least a faint sense or outline of the thought he thinks. The practitioner who strives to banish outline from his thought when treating a case weakens his treatment to the same extent that he banishes the outlines of perfection from his mentality or thought. It is right practice to banish all mental outline of disease when trying to destroy it, and it is equally correct practice to have a mental outline of health or perfection in mind when striving to give manifestation or visible expression to these realities. Yes, I know there is a statement in Science and Health, page 591, line 20, which reads, "Deity, which outlines but is not outlined." This statement has been pointed out to me by a number of students in refutation of my teaching that we should mentally outline in giving treatment. Mrs. Eddy's statement does not say, "Deity outlines, therefore you cannot." In fact, I fully agree with the statement that deity outlines, for I know that the mental element is deity, or the only creative force, and that I am of this same mental element, and therefore I can and should outline. On page 175, Science and Health, Mrs. Eddy wrote, "And we should efface the outline of disease already formulated in the mind of mortals. If it is possible for us to do this, and it is possible, then it is certainly also possible for us to outline the perfection that we desire expressed or embodied. And if it is correct practice that we should efface the imperfect outline when trying to destroy it, then it must also be correct that we should outline in mind the good which we desire to be manifest. It is a positive fact that the mentality gives visible expression embodiment to its thought ideals under certain mental conditions. If then a general thought ideal is held in mind, the result or manifestation must be general. If, on the other hand, a particular manifestation or embodiment is desired, then a particular thought ideal or mental outline is necessary to bring about the desired manifestation. I do not wish it understood that I advocate treating any particular part or organ of the body. The fact is that the body of the patient should not be treated at all, for the body is not conscious and therefore can know nothing about the treatment. It is correct practice to treat the mentality for an erroneous belief by paying especial attention to the destruction of the baneful conviction of sickness which the patient may have." Hear what Mrs. Eddy has to say on this subject, page 13, line 18, in Rudiment, Divine Science. "To aver that harmony is the real and discord the unreal, and then give special attention to what according to their own belief is diseased, is scientific. General thought ideals are statements of truth that are general, For instance, nothing but good can come to me or mind. This is a valuable thought to hold in the mind continually, and it acts as a preventative of ills. It finds fulfillment in a general improvement in the condition of the patient and his surrounding. It also is scientific to employ the particular right thought needed to correct a particular trouble or to fulfill a particular need. The so-called human being is almost entirely a creature of habit, of thought habit, although this is not understood or recognized. One individual, through association, thinks much of strong drink, gradually acquires a thought habit of constantly thinking strong drink, and then feels that he must satisfy this craving. We call such a one a drunkard and lay the blame to 100 different cases, except the one and the sole cause, his thought habit, which is never blamed for the trouble and not even suspected as the cause. If you can in any way break up or destroy this erring thought habit, you will find your drunkard healed. Some will try to heal themselves through determined will force, and occasionally one succeeds by sheer will in abstaining from strong drink. In most cases of this kind, however, the craving remains, and later, if the patient be sufficiently tempted, he again falls into the habit. To make a radical and permanent cure, one needs but to acquire a reverse thought habit and the desire for intoxicating liquor, as well as the craving will be overcome and disappear. Those who have overcome their desire for intoxicating liquor usually state that they have overcome intoxicants. This is an unwritten error. They have perhaps overcome their desire for intoxicants, but not until they have overcome the drunken effects following the drinking of intoxicants under test conditions can they rightfully lay claim to having overcome intoxicants. Nearly all well-meaning individuals who only occasionally are tempted to excessive drinking make strong resolutions and emphatically assure themselves that they will never indulge to excess again. This is the right start, but in short time they are again tempted and fall. When the individual decided to break the habit, he employed a certain thought to express his intention. For instance, he said, "I will never drink intoxicating liquor again." This is the right thought, and if he would only follow this up with more of the same character, he would soon acquire this kind of thought habit, and the old thought habit would be destroyed. Anyone, by affirming the following proposition, can, through constant application, free himself. "I will never drink strong drink again. I have no desire for it whatsoever. I will not allow my thought to dwell upon it, for such thought is wrong, and I am done with it forever." Even a confirmed drunkard can gradually free himself from the drink habit, if you will, in his sober moments, keep thinking these right thoughts with persistence and right intention. No matter if he does fall back a number of times, if he will persist in the use of these right thoughts, the time will come when he will no longer fall, and will then be complete master himself. If the friends surrounding the case will spend their time in sending right thoughts to the individual, instead of injuring him with the wrong thought that he is growing to be more of a drunkard at all time, he will be wonderfully helped by his right thinking instead of being hindered by the reverse thought which his friends usually send him. Help him to establish a thought habit of no desire for strong drink, and as rapidly as he gains control through this right thought habit, the error will be overcome. The erring thought habit of the drunkard have made a mind model of barrooms, bottles of intoxicants, and so-called congenial companions. And when his thought is not occupied by something else, this mind model of drink presents itself to his consciousness. He sees it clearly outlined, and thus the desire for more drink is established. Change the thought habit by constant opposite thoughts, and soon the mentality will have a new mind model at home, wife or parents perhaps, and in leisure moments this right mind model comes to consciousness and inclines his desire to the good and right side, and he will naturally follow the line of his desire. Frequently we find a child who seems obstinate and slow to obey. The parents of this child continually think of him as obstinate and disobedient, and at length they think and say, "I can do nothing at all with that child." These parents are, in almost every case, reaping the effect of their own wrong thought regarding their child, and are actually, through their wrong thinking, making him act as he does. Now reverse the process, and no matter what the evidence before the senses to the contrary may be, begin to think of the child as obedient, willing, honest, and good. Send a constant stream of this right thought to him, and the change that will soon take place in the action of the child will convince you that his former obstinacy and disobedience were the direct result of your erring thought. Do not expect miracles in a day, but a few weeks of right thought will make a change which you cannot fail to perceive. To think a child is dull is to begin to make him so. To think of him slow and sickly is to begin to make him so. And to think of him as quick and strong, bright and obedient is to begin to make him so. For the law of mind is that thought is the builder. It is a mistake to disbelieve this when it is so readily be tried out and proved by all. Take the case of an individual who is continually, habitually ailing. He has unwittingly acquired the habit of thinking that there is something always the matter with him, and in this way he's always created a mind model or mental picture of himself as always ailing. Every time this individual has time to think of himself, the mind model of imperfection which he has created comes to his mental view. He thinks of himself as ailing, and this very wrong thinking keeps creating more of his troubles. This will continue as long as the ailing model is mentally entertained. The remedy is the same as in the case of the drunkard. Only in the present case, the habit of thinking sickness is to be destroyed or cast out instead of the habit of thinking strong drink. The individual who has the thought habit of always ailing must acquire instead the habit of thinking of himself as always well and strong. If he persists in this right thought until he gains such a thought habit, he will, through his mental activity, create a new mind model of himself. Thereafter, when he thinks of himself, the new and right mind model will come to his consciousness, and he will think of himself as well and strong. And his right thinking will result in his creating or bringing into external being or experience the health and strength and happiness which he has been thinking. Thus are we sculptors of life. As reads a little poem, and this carving or externalizing of our thought is constantly taking place, regardless of whether we believe it to be true. None can change this process, for it is a law of life or God. In the words of Jesus, I can of my own self do nothing. I cannot change the laws that govern life or thought, but as I hear, I judge. All that I can do is to conform my thinking to the law, as far as I understand them, and thus gain desired result. In all the ordinary affairs of life, in business and mathematics and the like, it is clearly recognized and understood that wrong thought will bring wrong results. Why then should it seem so remarkable that wrong thought regarding health and success must bring wrong results, namely sickness and failure? The main reason that we have not become aware of the wonderful part that our thought plays in our lives is that the fact has never been clearly brought to our attention, and thought effects have been attributed to almost everything except to thought. In reality, thought is the underlying principle in all the universe, and therefore must be the fundamental cause of all activity, thought not so understood. And so-called chronic ailments, whether considered organic, inorganic, or even hereditary, are the result of wrong thought, either that the parents or of the individual. Nearly all the so-called chronic ills that come to the individual after maturity or late in life are the direct results of habit of wrong thought. These habitual wrong thoughts have completed their work of forming certain mind models for the individual, and he is now reproducing them in objectified form. Wrong thought habits are the seeds or roots of all the ordeals which we experience. Thus, wrong thought habits pertaining to form are objectified as imperfect form, pertaining to action as imperfect action, pertaining to feeling as wrong feeling. The wrong habits pertaining to feeling are responsible for what is called disposition. Once an evil disposition has been established, it enters into co-partnership with the wrong thought habit and acts as an intensifier, thus strengthening the evil feelings. These two errors together make the mind model of evil, which is very clear in outline, and as they are errors of feeling, they are objectified, as a rule, in ills that are very painful. Such ills can be permanently healed until both the wrong thought habit and the evil disposition have been changed. In the entire round of nature, we can observe the law that like produces like, and it is not different in the thought universe, for the external visible universe is but the visible effect of the invisible internal thought cause. The wrong thoughts and disposition which you habitually indulge and which gave pain to others did not go unrecorded in the great book of life, which is your mentality. While you were perhaps pleased with the feelings of pain, fear, and discomfort that you inflicted upon others, you may be very sure that you are not creating a bed of roses for yourself, but a bed of thorns. Upon this bed you must lie and there's no escape, other than to pluck these thorns out through a corresponding amount of right and loving thought. Life needs no bookkeeper to keep exact account, for the mental law is such that like produces like. This law is automatic and works in full accord with divine justice. It must not be supposed that each is compelled to go back and rectify all the errors and pain which he has created for others, for this would be impossible, and under such conditions none would ever be able to reach perfection or perfect mental harmony. The law of mind or God requires only that ye turn yourselves, and they shall be remembered no more. That is, desist from evil thinking and doing, and acquire the habit of right thinking, and they shall be remembered no more. The punishment or continuation of the ill after we have decided to turn ourselves consists in the fact that we are still the victims of wrong thought habits acquired by much wrong thought. We are put to necessity of thinking rightly continuously until the old habits are destroyed and we have established a new and better mind model. Thereafter, our habitual thought will be on the right side of the scale of justice, and we shall enjoy health, happiness, and success in greater measure than ever before. Those who have never acquired the thought habit of constantly dwelling on the good side of life have never experienced real happiness or real life. They have merely existed, but have never lived. Do not wait until tomorrow, but start today, right now, with a firm resolution never again to think a single thought that is not right. If the thought of sickness, anger, hate, fear, poverty knocks the door of your consciousness, meet it at the threshold with, "No, I will never again think such thoughts, for they are wrong, and being wrong they are wicked, and I will not for a moment lend myself as an accomplice to the devil." Wrong thinking is the one evil, or evil one, the devil. This is the method that Jesus used when tempting wrong thought came to his consciousness and brought forth the command, "Get thee behind me, Satan." And he added in substance, "It is written, it is the law of God, good, that I must think only good thoughts and none other." The chisel of the sculptor keeps cutting away, chip by chip, that which is not wanted or needed to form the perfect statue. So also we may, with our right thoughts of health, happiness, success, and love, chisel and chip away the ape of God. No and Yes, page 42, 1910 edition. The counterfeit of good which we have erringly fashioned with our wrong thought habits. Thus we may arise to a higher and holier plane, and approach that state of being which is foreshadowed in these words of Jesus, St. John 10:34. "Is it not written in your law, 'Ye are gods, and the scripture cannot be broken'?" If the readers of this booklet is an honest thinker and seeker, and wants fundamental proof to satisfy his unfolding thought that what has been briefly stated herein is correct, he needs but to read my book, The Sickle, and he will find proof satisfactory to himself. End of booklet.